the tension in that room was palpable. And so to have stepped out at that moment just didn't feel right either. Yeah, so I'm like trying to tell him yes in between my clenched teeth, and like, and it was funny when I watched it because it said whispers, like whispering across the bottom of the screen.
That's right. Retailers expect certain things from you now. You're an incredibly important partner. When they first bring you in, you're new. They don't care if you succeed or not. But once you've succeeded and then you've taken, you know, real estate on that shelf space, they need those monies.
Welcome to ProCo 360's Pro Business Colorado. This is a show about entrepreneurs who could be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. And whether it's mountain biking with a client or enjoying craft beer with colleagues at the office, my guests know that business in Colorado is special. Past shows, my Audible book list, and subscriber info are available at proco360.com. Again, that's proco360.com. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Megan and Scott Reamer, co-founders of Jackson's Honest, a brand of coconut oil cooked snacks created to address their son Jackson's rare illness. The Reamers appeared on Shark Tank, negotiating an investment of $1.25 million. We'll be talking about their journey, about building a brand from necessity, and about scaling from kitchen to manufacturing. Finally, I really can't wait to talk about this whole adventure in the Shark Tank. So, Megan and Scott, thanks for joining ProCo 360's Pro Business Colorado.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
I'm glad you're here, and we're going to jump in just a moment. First, I want to thank our show sponsors, Community Banks of Colorado. They go big for small business. They've been committed to this show since it started, demonstrating their love for entrepreneurs. And MicroStar Keg Logistics, these guys are entrepreneurs for beer entrepreneurs. MicroStar is a Colorado company that helps craft brewers expand by handling the logistics of keg distribution. Okay, Scott and Megan of Jackson's Honest, you ready?
Sure.
Yes, we are.
Good. So we even started our interview before the mic was going, but I wanted to talk first about this whole notion of starting your business from necessity. And let's set the stage for listeners who don't yet know the Jackson's Honest story. Could you share that with us? And then we'll dive into the whole business piece.
Yeah, sure. I like how you phrase that, built out of necessity, because we started Jackson's Honest to share some products that we made at home because of Jackson's rare autoimmune disease that he had. So if I back that up, Jackson started to show some symptoms around age 2 that gradually resulted in a loss of gross and fine motor skills over, you know, a 3-year period. And during that time, Scott and I were frantically trying to find a diagnosis and an explanation. And so we started to try to take control and manage the symptoms we were seeing with the only thing that was available to us, which was his diet. So we started to examine the types of foods we were feeding him, the fats, proteins, and carbs, and then really trying to classify them according to whether they were pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory. Because we thought at the root of whatever he was dealing with, because it looked so similar to something like ALS or multiple sclerosis, that it was inflammatory based. And so that's how we started basically making different types of foods at home for him to try to alleviate symptoms, neurological and digestive. These chips were one of those things that we made. And so as this process with Jackson continued, and it took us 12 years to find a diagnosis for him, we just continued to make these foods at home. And then some of them started to show up on the shelves, like bone broth and fermented foods, sauerkraut being one of those, jerky, you know, all these things. It became a convenient form factor for us to just go and buy them, you know, at the grocery store. These chips were not something that were showing up on the shelf. And so Scott and I decided, you know, we had this story to tell. We had a great product. And, you know, what if we threw our hat in the ring and decided to start a chip company? And so that's the root of Jackson's Honest.
Well, I think that's a great story. And now I'm wondering if that story has changed now that you've become a real business. You know, are people more interested in knowing about your product than about the origin of the business? How do you balance those stories?
I think it's twofold. I mean, people love the product. It tastes great, right? So that brings them to our place in the aisle, right? That brings them to purchase a bag of chips. But then they start to read the packaging. They start to look at the label. They start to wonder, why aren't other brands making in coconut oil, right? There's something that compels them to dig a little deeper. And when they do that, they find out that we're a mom and pop and, you know, the basis of this story, but also that there is a story behind it, right? That there's an intention around the business.
You know, so that's what I really want to talk about, because there is such a huge trend now. You build for companies to build businesses based on sort of tugging the heartstrings of customers. And there are so many, almost every company and others on Shark Tank and stuff too, look, if customers buy one, we're going to give one away. For every one we sell, we're going to give one away. I mean, even the car dealerships, we're going to give $200 away for every car we sell. And it's this whole, to me, there's such a difference between trying to manipulate sales through customer emotion versus, you know, a company like yours, which was formed to solve somebody's problems. And how do you guys see that?
You know, my first observation would be we should appreciate that people are being so generous, whether that car dealers or Patagonia or all these companies, whether it was in their DNA from the beginning or not. This sort of philanthropy is a net positive for everyone, right? And particularly those folks that are receiving that generosity. So on that basis, it's a wonderful thing for civil society. Having said that, as you just alluded to, there is an element of, was it in the DNA or was it acquired? And certainly
acquired is generous too.
yes.
Don't you think? I mean,
yeah. Well, there's an authenticity, right?
Exactly. There is an authenticity, right? And one of the things we like to say a lot is that we live in a story-based economy, particularly in the food space, because food becomes part of your body, that's different than a car or some technology, for instance, obviously from a consumer standpoint. But food does become part of you. And so people want to understand that, what is the story? What is the why for this particular food? Because it will tell them something about the quality. They can infer certain things about the quality of that food if they don't already know about it through the manner in which it got to the shelf and why it was made in the first place. And so for us, what other people do, we're less interested, frankly. We know why we started this and how we started it. And the wonderful thing, frankly, is we had no expectations this actually would be a going concern. This would actually be a business. At the end of the day, two people in a kitchen going up against Frito-Lay or Kettle Brand or some of these massive multinational conglomerate snack food companies, that was an impossibility. The fact that we actually have competed successfully against some of these companies is a remarkable thing, but it started out as a mission, just happened to turn into a good business.
Yeah, and isn't that, Megan, you mentioned the word authenticity. It seems to me that customers kind of see it. Mm-hmm. They kind of sense it. And it's a bit of a peeve of mine, this notion. I mean, there was a notion of greenwashing. Now, I suppose there's a notion of, I don't know, free washing. I don't know. People are just giving away stuff to try to manipulate sales. And I'm not a big fan of that. And I do hope that customers, and I appreciate your generous spirit, Scott, around, you know, it's good for, and it is good for, but I do appreciate companies that do it out of sincerity and authenticity.
And people will see through it, right? Consumers are incredibly important.
Because it's also not just your product and your packaging and what you're saying there that creates that brand equity with the sort of how genuine and authentic it is. It's through your social media channels as well, for instance, right? Like the types of images you're posting, the content that you're creating, that says a lot about your personality and who you are as well. And so there's a lot of different avenues people are reaching you.
There's talk no little, fooling consumers these days.
Yeah, we'll talk about the community. You've mentioned social media. Talk about the community of, I guess, product appreciators or some, I don't know how you would define it, but talk about your community.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think like Scott said, we didn't have any expectation when we started Jackson's Honest. And so the feedback and the customers that we heard from right out of the gate, you know, the early adopters, for instance, we thought we were this small, you know, tiny piece of the demographic that we're reading labels specifically for what type of carb and protein and very specifically fat was being used and how it was prepared. And so it was very eye-opening for us right out of the gate to have other people say, oh my gosh, I can eat chips again. I'd given them up because they were all cooked in these oils I wasn't eating. And so thank you. And then, you know, having that go to the next level, which are, you know, parents or individuals who are trying to look at their diet and read through the ingredient decks of the products they're eating in a different way, with a different lens around, will this maybe help solve or alleviate a medical condition I'm experiencing, or a behavioral condition that, you know, my grandson or granddaughter, whomever.
So here's what I'm wondering, as you're saying that, Megan, and for both of you, either one of you, as you explore these enthusiastic customers and their issues and their needs, and at the same time, right in parallel, you're building a business that's now multi-million dollar, right? How do you manage this notion of, I mean, of staying mission focused and purpose focused when you're dealing with employees, with vendors, with finances and all that? I mean, you're the finance guy, Scott. So how do you manage that?
Can I just say one thing before you start, Scott, which is that, you know, we've had incredible partners along all of those dimensions that you just mentioned the entire time, right out of the gate. We've been very lucky. We've brought this story to co-packers and potato suppliers, and, you know, just our reason to be and our reason for starting has drawn like-minded people with along those same dimensions to help us in our business and help be great partners for us as we've grown the business.
Including Whole Foods.
Including Whole Foods as well, yeah.
Does your passion for the mission and the authenticity around it attract better partners?
It certainly has for us, yes. Not only better partners, but more enthusiastic partners who are willing to do things and go out of their way and do things that wouldn't normally happen in the normal course of business. You know, Whole Foods gave us a loan to launch our Purple Heirloom potato chips, for instance.
Wow. And so that how much of a loan does Whole Foods?
$30,000.
Really? So it was enough to get into production, essentially.
Precisely. They said, we like this product. We'd love to sponsor it, in effect. And we said, great. And
I didn't know they even do that.
Yeah, it's a local loan producer program.
And so we, you asked earlier about the mission versus the business. And really, there are two different sides of the same exact coin. You know, one serves the other, right? So we need to have a fantastic supply chain that's multiply redundant. We need to have the best cost of goods we possibly can to meet consumers at a price point where they're willing to purchase the product. All of that serves the mission of bringing these ancestral fats back to the food chain. And so the mission, of course, is the DNA, and it starts there. But at the end of the day, there's a recursive element to running the business institutionally, as efficiently as we can. And one of the things we've really focused on in the last year is the process of running the business. It, you know, it went from a mission to a business, and we didn't realize that it needs to be institutionalized.
Yeah, all of a sudden, yeah. So at what point in sales did you decide, wow, we got to turn this into a process?
When we got to $1 million, we're like, I can't believe that just happened. Yeah. We really thought we'd sell a couple hundred.
How long did that take? In a year. 12 months.
Yeah. Went from nothing to $1 million. We're like, gosh, this is a real business. That's the point at which we realized, hey, this could be a business. Mm-hmm. Like, we now should treat it as such and try to understand the cost of goods sold and the supply chain and actually starting hiring people. And so it wasn't until that point at which we realized that we needed to think about it as a business to serve the mission.
Mm-hmm. Did that take any of the fun out of it for you, or did that just ramp it up?
No, it really didn't. I mean, one of the things you asked about were employees, and they're all, the team we have has been drawn to fundamentally the mission first and the intention and why we're doing what we're doing. So having that energy in-house and in our office just continues to supplement and support what we're doing, because no, it didn't take any of the fun out.
Well, that's cool. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to ProCo 360's Pro Business Colorado. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and this is the show featuring entrepreneurs and business leaders who could be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. I'm speaking with Megan and Scott Reamer, co-founders of Jackson's Honest. And I want to shift gears. We're going to come back to this operational aspect in a little bit, but I want to shift gears because I've been dying to talk to you all week about this episode of Shark Tank. And it was so funny that I saw you on it. And anyway, I'm a big fan. When you decided to do that, what was your objective?
There were a few objectives. Number one, we wanted to be able to share this story and our brand and Jackson's story to a much larger audience than we would normally have access to. And these aren't in order of priority. That was just, you know, one of the considerations. The second was, you know, actually doing a deal, partnering with the right shark to elevate and sort of leapfrog some fundamental steps, particularly around branding and marketing, that we would have had to have, you know, gone through, I'd say, over the next 24 months, 18 months, something like that, or possibly even longer,
sure.
Right?
Yeah. Up until we actually did that deal with Rohan, was we had spent approximately $74,000 lifetime to date on any sort of branding or marketing, and that was to achieve about $23 million in lifetime sales. So it was, you know, a couple basis points in marketing.
Yeah.
Traditionally,
yeah.
consumer brands will spend anywhere up to 10% of sales on marketing. We spent nothing.
Wow.
And so we had underutilized that as a resource and as a plan. Mm. And so that one of the elements that Megan just mentioned was really important to us, was trying to get help. How do we speak to consumers in a way that, frankly, we weren't even having conversations before?
Wow. Wow.
And I'd say the other part of that consideration was just understanding our business, right? I mean, that process of speaking, preparing, and then pitching to the sharps, we really needed to dive in.
Tell me, share with the listeners and with me what the prep was, because it seems like you got to really get your pitch down.
Yes, correct.
You do. What was that prep
and
like?
It's real time in there. It's not edited. It's not scripted. It's just cameras rolling for us, it was 60 minutes that we were in there talking to them.
Mm. Yeah. And so we prepped, you know, we happened to be going through a parallel capital raise process with traditional CPG venture capitalists and private equity guys. And so we, for 2.5 months prior to that, our airing, or that is to say, I shouldn't say airing, our taping, which is in late June, we had been basically doing, you know, 2 to 3 times a week doing a mini Shark Tank with a bunch of professional investors.
Yeah, but they don't want you to be cute. And they don't, do they?
Not at all.
No. So we had to answer. And on Shark Tank, you want to be, you know.
But the pressure.
You have to be photogenic.
Yeah. But there was a pressure element. There was a knowing your facts element. Yeah. There was a cogency that was necessary for the story. And so those things helped immensely.
Yeah. So you had kind of prepped through practice, which is, you could tell sometimes people get like, this is their first big pitch. You guys have been doing it.
We had been doing it.
Yeah. So, hey,
so we were able to relax a little bit into the kind of interaction with the sharks, because we felt like we knew the numbers we needed. We felt like we could answer their financial and operational questions.
Yeah, and you guys had success. I want to ask Luke to play a clip that I pulled from your episode.
I like you guys. I like your background. I usually don't even come off my 20 because I know the value that I add. All right, my final offer is 15% for the 1.25.
Rohan, we'd love to take your offer.
Outstanding.
Thank God.
Congratulations,
ship
Rohan.
Of a day.
Thank you.
Let's go do this.
Thank you.
I love your product. It's terrific.
You guys are both cracking up now as I play that. Is that bringing back a... Does that bring back a good memory for you?
There's a sense memory there. It was a lot of fun. And you know what you didn't necessarily see is that, again, we were on there for an hour. There was 20 minutes of that sort of back and forth negotiation with Rohan. So it condensed down to about 90 seconds, but there was 20 minutes of back and forth. So the catharsis of actually saying yes to the deal after 20 minutes of negotiation was wonderful for us personally.
Scott and I realized right at that moment, which is one of the reasons I was laughing, that we had no secret signal, no secret for like, let's take the deal, right? We kind of had gone through these different scenarios on valuation and equity stake. And then we looked at each other and it was like, oh, we needed to, you know, tug our ear or wipe our cheek or something, whatever yes and no was.
I noticed that when I looked at the video clip, like you're looking at each other like, how do we communicate? Because I'm sure you want to just reach over and put your hand around each other's ears and like, right?
And you could step out.
They give you the option to step out and, you know, have this sort of private conversation. But the tension in that room was palpable. And so to have stepped out at that moment just didn't feel right either.
Yeah,
so I'm like trying to tell him yes in between my clenched teeth and like, and it was funny when I watched it because it said whispers, like whispering across the bottom
screen.
That's right.
That's great. Now, so I'm going to ask you some other questions about this because you always wonder what happened after the deal. I mean, is there like a written agreement? How does that work?
Well, the formal due diligence process starts, right? So this is a verbal agreement.
This isn't a real deal.
It's a verbal commitment, which you necessarily need to make. And then you will go through a formal due diligence process. Of course, the transaction will be papered and the money's wired and all that sort of stuff and rights discussed and things like that. So it is a traditional deal in the sense that it eventually gets through that after after the negotiation.
Was there anything in it that you didn't anticipate or that like, wow, what did we get ourselves into?
No,
Rohan's a great guy. And our conversations afterward with him have been really positive, and he is very engaged. He's, you know, rolling up his sleeves and helping us get to business and, you know, making introductions and, you know, really trying to help operationally around some pieces that he's good at. And so it's been very interactive.
Yeah. And so after you got off the show, how long did it take to actually, did you get all the cash all at once, like in your account?
No. You have to go through all that due diligence process. And that can take, you know, even the executive producers told us this. It could take anywhere from 30 to 120 days, depending on the shark's schedule and how fast the due diligence moves and such. So, it can take some time.
At least a quarter. Once you're through that, do you all of a sudden one day have $1.25 million in your account?
Oh, yeah. It's like any other investment where the money gets wired once the once the contract is signed.
Yeah.
Wow. What did you do when you saw that in your account?
We paid some bills.
Excellent.
It's expensive running a food company, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yeah. Hey, I want to remind our listeners again, you're listening to ProCo 360's Pro Business Colorado. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and I'm speaking with Megan and Scott Reamer, co-founders of Jackson's Honest. Please visit my website at ProCo360.com. I've added sections for what listeners are saying, what guests are saying, and my blog. Again, that's at ProCo360.com. And you mentioned right before I reminded our listeners of who you are, that it's expensive to run a food business. I want to talk about that whole notion of scaling from, for every one of you, there's 10,000, 100,000 people who actually intentionally try to start a food business. Maybe the secret is doing it unintentionally. I don't know. But talk about the scaling piece.
Yeah, it was the single most difficult part of this, principally because we didn't have any experience in CPG, so we didn't necessarily know how to do it ahead of time. So we learned in real time, and very much we're sort of drinking from the fire hose in that way. And
because
so,
our growth was so fast.
Yes, exactly.
And so doing it real time had some real challenges.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, you know, this is one of the things as consumers, as parents first, and then consumers of these goods first before we ever tried to make them and sell them, we thought we just sort of took it for granted. Like, oh, I could go to any grocery store and get as many products as I want at a pretty good price. The actual logistics of that, from the field and the farm all the way to the shelf is remarkably difficult and has a ton of different intermediaries in that process. And all of those intermediaries need to be aligned from a timeline standpoint. And also you have to find all of those to begin with and then negotiate great prices. So it's incredibly difficult. And we really appreciate now how hard it is to get a bag of chips from a potato in the field to Whole Foods.
So if I gave you 60 seconds, could you describe that process?
Not probably 60 seconds, but I'll do the best I can. So, we have to buy potatoes, which need to be grown 6 months in advance. And so we have to predict 6 months out what we think our sales are going to be. And sales are seasonal, right? People eat more potato chips between May and September than they do the other seasons. Yeah. And so we actually grow bespoke potatoes, purple potatoes, sweet potatoes, red potatoes. These are unlike.
Well, you don't grow them. You contract to buy them, right?
In some cases, we contract to grow them. Huh. And so, this is because they're bespoke to us, that you can't find these a lot of different places. And we're buying tens of thousands of pounds at a day. And so, in some cases. And so, doing that in advance and then getting them to where they have to be at just the right time. These things can't sit around.
Is that your job?
That's our job. That's our job.
Really? So you don't have somebody, the grower doesn't, you don't contract to have them delivered to the manufacturer?
In some cases, we actually line up the logistics. And so it has to be there at a specific time. They can't sit around for 4 months. They have to be taken out of the ground and fried. And so so it has to be at the manufacturing facility a very specific time when they have line time. And then it has to be delivered to a distribution point at a very specific time, or they'll charge you late fees. And then it has to be then delivered to Whole Foods, for instance, or Sprouts or Natural Grocers. And so
that sounds like work.
It's a ton of work. We really appreciate viscerally how difficult it is to get a bag of potato chips or any other snack or any food on a grocery store shelf. It's incredibly challenging.
So does that, I just die when I think of this. I mean, here you are, you have this almost romance around the notion of a mission-driven company that serves healthy products and all that. And then that's what we all see. That's what we buy for $3 or $4. And yet you're in there worrying about when you're going to get potatoes delivered. I mean, there's a real disconnect between the romance and the allure and the real work.
Absolutely. What you see is the tip of an iceberg, right? And the 9/10 of the iceberg is the process, the manufacturing, the scaling that is so challenging. And when you go from 1 million to 10 million in 2 years, that process becomes you know, geometrically more difficult. You know, 1 million to 1.5 million, you know, you can handle that. But how do you scale from 1 to 10 when you have to put potatoes in the ground 6 months out?
Well, let me ask you this, because that seems to me like if you're going to from 1 million to 10 million, you've got all this money. Now you can sort of pay for efficiencies, pay to make it easier, pay to make it quicker. And Megan's just making faces because that's not right. That's not
quite how the model works.
No. So it doesn't get that. It doesn't get easier as you get bigger, what you're saying?
It's actually much more challenging.
Yeah, it's much more challenging. It seems like, you know, it's just constant sort of this marathon, right? So what's the end point? What is the finish line? Where is it?
Because the process, the rules change as you go, as you get faster and bigger, that you have to reason.
Yes, because retailers expect certain things from you now. You're an incredibly important partner. When they first bring you in, you're new. They don't care if you succeed or not. But once you've succeeded and then you've taken real estate on that shelf space, they need those monies. They need people to come back and buy your product. So you become an important part of their value chain and they have expectations. Financial and performance expectations about your partnership with them. And so the whole thing changes once you go from 1 to 10.
And even just the pay to play that's required to get on the shelf with some retailers, but then the marketing programs that you need to do to participate with them, the promotional calendar that you need, that's all a lot of investment on the brand side.
Well, and pricing is an interesting component too, because you sell a premium product and at some point, customers accept that, and at some point, they don't. Mm-hmm. So how do you come up with that, and do you have to do that in conjunction with your retailers?
Yeah, we have a suggested retail price, right? And so this was one of the biggest decisions we ever made as a company, was reducing the price from $4.99 to $3.99. We did that because we never wanted to be a super premium product that was only available to a small demographic of folks that have that kind of disposable income. Mm-hmm. We always wanted to be available to as many people as possible. That's the mission. And so when we reduced those prices, obviously our gross margins went down, the business became more challenging, so it forced us to be much more efficient in the cost of goods side. So for us, it's actually remarkably difficult to get that price to a place where we want it to serve the mission, but also to serve consumers' interest, which is to buy products as cheaply as they can.
Well, do you also have some question around which stores you should be in to support your brand?
And what I was going to add on to Scott, which gets to your point, is, we really need to know who our customers are, because we're not chasing every customer that buys potato chips. So that also defines which retailers to work with.
Got it. And I would think some are more helpful to you along the way as well. And,
for sure.
And so I suppose you want to reward their loyalty with product.
Right. Yeah. And I think for us, it's been just trying to understand and be very smart around distribution. We don't need or want or can support being everywhere and just trying to get on shelves across the country in every retailer. We want to make sure that we're partnering, truly partnering, supporting the retailer in the way they need to be supported, and also, supporting our brand and our growth and what we need to check, the boxes that we need to check.
That's exactly right. Yeah. If we wanted to be in all of the conventional grocers around the nation, it would cost us millions of dollars in slotting fees. We simply do not have that. Say nothing about supporting the sales on the shelf once it's on the shelf. So there are financial boundary conditions around which we simply cannot exist that prevent that type of growth.
Well, it sounds like you've learned a lot the hard way as you've grown the business.
Yes.
When you think back of one or two specific lessons you learned the hard way, what do you reflect on and say, wow, glad we learned that, glad we figured that out, but boy, that was painful.
For me, I would say it's the cost of distribution, right? So once we figured out how to get potatoes or corn into a potato chip or tortilla chip and then get it manufactured the exact specific way that we need to manufacture it, which is different than other folks. Okay, it's sitting there, it's in a final package. Fantastic. The job is done. Well, actually, the hard part then begins. How do you get that to the shelf, and not just to a shelf in Denver, but a shelf in Sacramento, a shelf in Fort Lauderdale, a shelf in Atlanta or in Maine. Those logistics are unbelievably challenging and costly. So Megan spent an enormous amount of time understanding, lanes, and there are costs of lanes. All those trucks you see on the highway, all of those, some of those are full of Jackson's Honest chips. And so
isn't that nice?
It's very nice, but at the end of the day, there's every one of those lanes are different price and have different implications for our profitability and have to be optimized around a certain set of parameters.
Megan, what about you?
Yes, I mean, I think the lessons that we've learned the hard way all revolve around operations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for instance, we learned with probably 3 weeks' notice that a large retailer wanted to put certain SKUs on their shelves. And one of the SKUs we didn't have, we just simply didn't have the inventory. Mm. It was the wrong time of year. The crop wasn't ready to be harvested yet. So we were scrambling what we were going to do and trying to troubleshoot what the answer was to that problem. It resulted in us creating some new supply chain relationships, right? So, yeah. So we were able to reach out to other potato farmers and continue a relationship with them because we had to solve this immediate problem. And so there have been, you know, other examples, mm-hmm. but they mostly reside along the supply chain.
Got it. And before we're done, I want to remind our listeners, this started as a family business. Are your kids involved in this?
They are.
Talk about that and how you weave them in or don't.
Well, they went from literally frying chips with us because Scott and I made these by hand for mm-hmm. about a year before we started selling them in retail. But we were already selling them to like little small mom and pop stores and local health food stores. And so they were helping us fry chips. They were, you know, helping melt the oil. They were helping slice them and slice the potatoes. And so, you know, for them, it's been this very kind of supportive and emotional rallying around their brother and, you know, the circumstance that he was living in and the rare disease that he was suffering from. And so, you know, for us, it's been this mobilizing effort to support him and support turning this experience that could have been perceived as negative into something very positive. And so, you know, turning lemons into lemonade for all of us. Mm-hmm. They love going into a grocery store and seeing a display of Jackson's Honest, or like checking the shelves with us and facing up the bags and making them look pretty. And, you know, they take a lot of pride in that. And they love to hear their friends say, oh, we only eat Jackson's Honest mm-hmm. at my house.
Right? And they've come to us for some media events to Los Angeles just last week. They've gone to store openings with us and passed out chips. So make them an intimate part of it because it is their story as much as ours.
What a great learning experience for them.
Indeed.
As you think about where you are now, this is kind of how I want to wrap up. I mean, you started out as caring parents trying to solve a problem, and now you're entrepreneurs with sales of
More than $10 million.
More than $10 million.
Per year.
A booming business. I mean, do you see yourselves differently now than you did when you started?
No, not at all.
Because
we're still in the weeds with running the business and, like Scott mentioned, all the operational stuff that he's involved in. And I, you know, am equally as involved in that as well as other parts of the business. And so there's no aspect of being hands-off Jackson's Honest for us. And so I don't think we feel changed at all by the experiences we've had today. It's very much a real story for us and something that we want to continue to be able to share with customers.
It was unexpected for sure. And we're absolutely humbled by saying, it's really amazing to hear ourselves say that, like, hey, we had $10 million in sales last year and we're growing at a very rapid clip. So that's humbling for sure, but it's changed nothing about the mission and why we exist. And there's no price point, there's no success level that will cause us to change that that feeling, because that's why we started this company, for the mission. And if what we're doing serves a mission, all the better, no matter what size we are.
Excellent. I think that's a great note to wrap on. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. And today on ProCo 360's Pro Business Colorado, I've been speaking with Megan and Scott Reamer, co-founders of Jackson's Honest, a brand of coconut oil cooked snacks created for their son, Jackson. I've had a great time talking with you, Megan and Scott, about your journey, about building a brand from necessity, about scaling from kitchen to manufacturing, and about your adventure on Shark Tank. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Thanks for having us. It's been fun.
Appreciate it.
It has been great. And again, this is Dave Tabor. Thanks again to show sponsors MicroStar Cake Logistics, Community Banks of Colorado, and Jones and Keller. Thanks to my producer, Luke Woodruff. This show and past shows are available via your favorite podcast app. Search ProCo 360. Again, that's ProCo 360. Or go to ProCo360.com to listen and subscribe to my newsletter. Again, that's ProCo360.com. Thanks for listening.